Our field of thought are basically repetitive patterns that are crossing over each other all the time that we get fixated on and that we find ourselves coming back to again and again. There are other patterns. There's a pattern of awareness, a pattern of being that also we can focus on too. So if we begin to eliminate the pattern of say negative or harmful or distracted thinking and replace it with patterns of awareness and presence, then we begin the process of yoga.
Hi, everyone. It's Marnie Salop. Thanks for tuning into my podcast, Marnie on the Move. Each week, I will be inviting interesting, innovative movers and shakers to join me on the show and share their story. You will discover and hear from thought leaders, experts, influencers, and entrepreneurs from the worlds of wellness, sports, beauty, fitness, fashion, and more. Marnie on the Move will feature an eclectic mix of people I know, work with, and think are generally doing cool things. On each episode, I sync up with my guests about life, career, and training, and showcase their expertise and story. 30 years ago today, a New York City, Greenwich Village native, and punk rocker left his retail day job selling records at the iconic Bleecker Bobs to study yoga and pursue his teacher training degree in India. Upon his return to New York, he opened a studio that changed the New York City and global yoga landscape forever. His name is Eddie Stern. Today, Eddie is a world-renowned yoga teacher, highly respected thought leader, entrepreneur, author, and recently a mobile app innovator. He is the co-founder of Ashtanga Yoga New York, the Brooklyn Yoga Club, and the Broome Street Temple with his wife and yoga teacher, Jocelyn Stern. He is also the co-founder of Namarupa Magazine with Robert Moses and recently teamed up with Deepak Chopra and Mobi to launch a new app, the Breathing App. Eddie began teaching yoga in 1989, at a time where there were very few yoga studios in New York City, and it was not a very popular mainstream practice. Yoga catered to a culture of people that were interested in pursuing the spiritual aspects of their lives, not very asana or physically focused. It was no frills, glitz, or glamour. People didn't drop in to take a class. It was a very different world compared to today, where there are tons of studios. Eddie studied with yoga legend and Ashtanga founder, Guru Sri K. Patabi Joyce from 1991 to 2009, also known as Guruji or Patabi Joyce. And he brought Guruji's teachings to New York City, which gained notoriety amongst popular celebrities, musicians, and yoga practitioners. Eddie has since expanded from his original one-room studio to a beautiful townhouse in downtown Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, that is the home to his studio and Ganesh Temple, also a B&B for guests to immerse themselves and experience the culture, and a cafe with vegan healthy snacks. This is where I am now. Full disclosure, Eddie has also been my yoga teacher, who I have practiced with now on and off for over 15 years, but the past 3 years have been more off. So I'm really excited to be back practicing. I came back this Saturday and using this podcast as a way to kind of set the tone for my own intentions to get back to yoga, because I feel like when I was practicing yoga, I was not injured. I did not have any issues doing all the other things that I do, like triathlon and running, cycling, swimming, and generally picking things up off the floor and jumping into my car. And then when I stopped practicing, I've had, you know, countless things go on. And I think it's because I was practicing 2 to 3 times a week and the regular routine and ritual was very helpful physically and also mentally, because I honestly think that if I didn't have yoga as a practice, I wouldn't be where I am today. So with that, I'm really excited to introduce Eddie. Thank you so much for having me at your townhouse and your studio.
Thanks for having me on your show.
So I would love to start with, for my listeners who maybe are not dialed into Ashtanga, don't really know who Patabi Joyce is or what the practice is, if you could sort of share a little bit about that.
Sure. Throughout India and in different places, there are different ways of doing yoga. And wherever you travel in the subcontinent, you find different approaches. In South India, there are regional differences, just like there are with food and with language. And Pattabhi Joyce had a particular way of teaching, which was based on something called vinyasa, which meant linking of breath and movement together. And the vinyasas were stringing together something called asanas, which are static positions. And so all of these static positions that we stay in for, 45 seconds or a minute at a time are strung together through these connected movements called vinyasa. So that's what he taught. It became very popular in the West and spurred a whole movement of yoga, which later became called vinyasa yoga, which is very popular now in America, at least, which did not exist 20 years ago. But it's like a hybrid creation that happened over here. So when you hear vinyasa yoga or vinyasa flow, which is a redundancy, then you know that its roots are in the teachings from Pattabhi Joyce and from his teacher, Krishnamacharya, and also another teacher named Desikachar, who was Krishnamacharya's son. That's what it is. It's a challenging practice. It is very engaging on multiple levels. You have your body, you have your breath, you have your attention that are all coming together at the same place at the same time, which is why it's such a powerful practice.
And how did you come to discover Ashtanga?
I came to discover it because I knocked on Pattabhi Joyce's door in South India after I'd been guided there by an elderly Indian gentleman who heard I was looking to learn yoga. I didn't know what Ashtanga yoga was. I didn't know who Pattabhi Joyce was. And I had no idea that I would spend the next, 19 or 20 years of my life studying under him.
And what has your journey been thus far? Like, where did you start? Where did you begin before you practiced Ashtanga?
I started yoga in New York City. When I was around 18, I was working at a record store called Bleecker Bob's, and a guy who worked in the record store had done some yoga. But mainly it was like meditation and chanting and, reading philosophy books, not so much postures. So I did that for a while. And back then there were only a couple of yoga schools in New York, and eventually I found my way to them and started going to all of them. And by the time I was 19 or 20, that's really all I was interested in doing. And then when I was 20, right after I turned 21, then I went to India to do my teacher training at a place called Shivananda. And that was it. And that was, 30 years ago.
When did you open the yoga studio in New York?
1995. I started teaching Shivananda style yoga in 89. And then I started teaching Ashtanga yoga in 93. And then my wife and I opened our first school in 1995.
And that was Broome Street Temple?
No, that was called the Patanjali Yogashala. And that was on in the Cable Building at 611 Broadway, which is one of those iconic, downtown Soho buildings. Mm-hmm. We were there for 5 years, and then we moved down to Broome Street. At that point, the name of the school changed because Sharat, who's Guruji's grandson, wanted all the yoga schools to have these like cohesive names, Ashtanga Yoga, and then whatever city that they were in. So we became Ashtanga Yoga New York around that time, around the year 2000. Then we built the temple in 2001, and then we were Ashtanga Yoga New York and the Sri Ganesha Temple.
What made you decide to build a Ganesh temple?
Because I wanted to build a temple. We already had a statue of Ganesh, and I wanted to do a proper installation. When you do a proper installation of a deity, basically you're basically establishing an energy presence in the temple. And it's a complicated process. And I asked Guruji or Pattabhi Joyce if we could do that and which deity we should do it with. And he said to do it with Ganesha.
And what does Ganesha stand for? Just for people who don't know, because Ganesha is my favorite deity.
Yeah, Ganesha is the elephant-headed god. And actually, the word god in Sanskrit is deva. And deva means a being of light, sort of like angels in Christianity. So it's right. Not god like god, but,
right.
So the devas, the beings of light, are similar to light as you would see it in physics. So, for example, light is a wave, and when you're not observing it, exists everywhere at all times equally. But when you observe it, then it becomes a particle. So the beings of light, or the devas, are basically like light waves that exist uniformly everywhere. But when you observe them, they become a particle, and you can predict where they will be and all those types of things. So with all of the Indian gods, which are devas, when they're observed, they take on a form, and these forms have many arms or different types of heads and things like that. But they're basically symbolic representations of aspects of reality, and Ganesh happens to be the ruler of obstacles. He removes obstacles, the ones that need to be removed. He places the ones that need to be there. So in fact, basically what he does is he embodies all obstacles, because from an obstacle, you learn something. If you come up against an obstacle and you want to, like, say you're a long distance runner and you're really good at running 23 miles, but hitting 24 and then hitting 26 to do a whole marathon is like you hit a stumbling block. But when you figure out a way to get around that 23rd mile, that 24th mile, then you get wisdom from having hit up against that blockage,
right,
and then conquered it. So he's both the obstacle and the wisdom that comes along from knowing what to do with that obstacle. Some obstacles, they need to be there.
Right.
Maybe we're not supposed to spend time with this person. Maybe we shouldn't be going for that job. Maybe we shouldn't be eating that kind of food or doing this kind of activity, and something shows itself in our life, which is an indication to you that this is wrong because you need to go that other direction. And so Ganesha is also the embodiment of the wisdom that comes from listening to what life is telling you. So if you look at an elephant has really big ears, which is symbolic of listening well, and a small mouth, meaning don't talk too much, but listen more. And if you listen to the people around you and to life around you, then you'll understand, you'll get wisdom and knowledge about where should I go next. And the elephant is also a massive and majestic animal that can walk through the forest and uproot a tree with its trunk and throw it off to the side, or pick up something very small if it needs to. So an elephant knows which way to go, and it has a discrimination to uproot the big things and be gentle with the small things, to communicate through touch, to care for, you know, people around it, to show empathy. All these things elephants do. So when we look at Ganesha, we get reminded of all these things that we should embody in our lives as well.
That's really interesting and such a wonderful explanation of the deities. Since I began my practice, I have collected many Ganeshas and Buddhas over the years. Being raised Jewish, I've often been asked many questions about how I have these in my home, or am I praying to these as idols? Honestly, I never really thought of it that way. For me, it's always really been about an energy or a reminder of what that deity represents. So I think this is really a great clarification of what it means.
In Judaism, we are not supposed to bow to graven images, but the representation of aspects of reality are not graven images. If you look at a piece of stone and you say, that is God, then you're taking an object and you're turning it into something which it's not. So the stone is not God. The stone is a reflection of an idea about how we should be living our lives. So all of the deities that you see in the Hindu pantheon, they're not gods. They're not idols. At best, they're icons. But what they really are they are reflections and manifestations of ways that we should be living our lives. So now, right now I'm studying with an Orthodox rabbi for my bar mitzvah. I decided for my 50th birthday I was going to have my bar mitzvah. I never had it. And so we discuss all these things. He knows there's a Ganesh temple downstairs, but he also understands, how does Hinduism look at the form? It's not the form which is being worshipped. The form is being used as a jumping off point for reflection. One of the words for a deity in Sanskrit is bimba, which literally means reflection, or vigraha, that which is grasping your attention or your awareness.
Speaking of reflections and awareness, I was reading one of your recent blog posts where you reflect and remark upon a quote by Jack Kornfeld, "What we practice is who we become." And then in the same blog post, you go on to write about the Chandogya Upanishad that says that within the wheel of life, the heart is the hub of our existence. And you write about here how often we get lost within the spokes and need to come back to the hub. Can you share the essence of this post with my listeners? It's so good.
So this is from the Chandogya Upanishad that basically says the heart is our hub. So if you imagine a bicycle wheel, it has a center, which is called a hub, and then there are a lot of spokes coming out from it, and then there's a tire around it. The tire around the wheel is the wheel of life. It's where everything's spinning around and happening and carries us forward. The heart is the center of all of it, and it's held together by these spokes. And what the Upanishad says is that when we are living our lives, we get lost in all of the various spokes. So, for example, say you come to yoga or you come to run and you're new to it. And you first start doing it and everything's beautiful. Everything's awesome. Everything's wonderful. You feel free. You feel calm. You feel open. You're looking at the world through new eyes. You found a way that you can do this thing for an hour and a half every day. And you just feel like I am set. I am one with myself. I know who I am. And then some weeks go by and some months go by. And before you know it, you're taking your yoga class and you start looking at the person next to you and you start thinking, that person's doing that pose really well. I wish I could do it that well. Maybe I should take like a weekend workshop or something like that. And so I'm going to amp up my game so I can get better at these postures. And maybe I need even a better yoga mat. And then if I got a better yoga mat, then my hands wouldn't slip so much in downward dog. And then I'd really make some progress. And so then you get that better yoga mat and you think, you know, I've been wearing these cutoff shorts for a long time. Maybe if I got some better shorts and like a nicer t-shirt so I didn't sweat so much that then I could really, you know, I'd have this like all my perspiration would be wicked away and then I'd be great in this practice. And maybe I need a mala bead also because I'm starting to feel kind of spiritual. And now that I have mala beads, I should learn a mantra, you know? Oh, and that mantra might not be getting me the right stuff I want. Maybe I need a better mantra. So before we know it, we've gone from being in this thing which makes us feel totally at one with ourselves to thinking we need all this stuff to be better at that thing we're doing. And it happens very quickly without us even thinking about it. The same thing can happen with running. You start running, you feel great, then you want better running shoes, you want better running shorts. You get a running coach. You know, you start challenging yourself. You think, oh, if I could only run, you know, that 10K, then I'd really feel that I got somewhere. Oh, maybe I should do a 25K. And so these things start seeping into our minds. And what these things are, they're the spokes. And we've come out from the hub and now we're like living in the spokes and we get lost there. And that's what the wheel of life is. It's getting lost in the spokes. So what we want to do is we want to recognize when we've gotten lost and use that thing to turn us back towards the hub. Quite often we live in the spokes and we think that the spokes are who we are. I am this person who does yoga. I am this person, you know, who runs, and that's how I'm, or I'm this person who writes, or who has a blog post, or does a podcast, or is a teacher, whatever it is that we do, is it runs a hedge fund. And that's my identity. But the identity of the spokes is just something spinning around. And actually, we are who we are. We're consciousness, we're awareness, we're a human being, we're a loving heart. Any of the things that we want to identify is who we really are. And then the who we are has particular expressions. The who we are might be expressing itself through doing yoga, through creating art. But the who we are is not qualified because we do yoga. The who we are is not qualified because we run or play music or whatever. And so we just have to flip it a little bit. And that's what that is all about. The Jack Kornfeld quote was very nice because what we practice is who we become. Struck a chord in me because Patabi Joyce used to say, practice all is coming, which is, I was writing about that because it's a throwaway line, you know, people use it all the time without even thinking about what it means. And in fact, it's one of those phrases that I really detest in the Ashtanga yoga world. You know, practice is, and it's 99% practice, 1% theory. You know, if I hear that one more time, you know,
right,
it'll be 1% too many times or 99% too many times. So, you know, all these catchphrases are things that people say, but they don't always really think about them too much. And then it becomes an easy thing to say. Maybe you hear it once and it has an effect on you, but then you keep repeating it in almost any situation. And then it's on a t-shirt and then it's just on a coffee cup and that's dumb.
Right.
You know, that's not where wisdom is meant to be.
Because it diminishes the the phrase or the catchphrase.
Exactly. So when Guruji used to say all is coming, you know, people sometimes would ask him, when will I get to do this pose better? Or when will my practice be perfect? Or when will I learn, you know, this blah, 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 blah. And they were looking for end goal results. And what he was saying was the all was that, you know, that posture doesn't really matter all that much. The all is consciousness. The all is everything. The right. all is the infinite. The all is not you're going to get a lot of money. You're going to get good at poses. You're going to get the, you know, right kind of clothes. That's not the all. The all is all. It's the infinite. So that's where you're headed. And when you get there, or when you open to that inside of yourself, then the striving for all the questions that you're asking fall away.
Right.
So if you practice yoga to have a really good Instagram post, that's who you become.
Right.
You know, if you exactly. practice yoga, if you do really cool poses just so you can get a lot of likes, you just become someone who's getting a lot of likes. But if you practice yoga to, or meditation to be a more thoughtful, kinder, loving, gentle person, then that's who you become also. So it's not just what you practice, but the way you practice it will be who we become. And that is, I just thought he said it very nicely. And I thought, that's so nice. I'm going to write about that.
And the Yoga Sutra that I always like to hear you talk about, which I want to ask you about now, is Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha.
Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha is an equation, basically. So it is yoga equals the Nirodha, or the selective elimination, or the removal of the chittas, the fluctuations of the thoughts, removing the vrittis, which are the fluctuations in the thoughts, and the field of chitta, or the field of the mind, or the field of consciousness, or conscious awareness. So yoga equals the selective elimination of particular vrittis, particular movements of mind, of thought, in this field. So basically, the chitta is this neutral field, and things occur in this field. So if you look at a lake, like you said, a lake might be very calm without a ripple in it, but a breeze blows and there's some ripples, and then a breeze blows in another way and the ripples cross over each other. Maybe a small leaf or a rock drops into the pond and more ripples are created. And before you know it, you have all these crisscrossing ripples, which are creating a pattern. And this pattern is basically repeats itself over and over and over again as the ripples cross over each other. So our field of thought are basically repetitive patterns that are crossing over each other all the time that we get fixated on and that we find ourselves coming back to again and again. There are other patterns. There's a pattern of awareness, a pattern of being that also we can focus on too. So if we begin to eliminate the pattern of say negative or harmful or distracted thinking and replace it with patterns of awareness and presence, then we begin the process of yoga. And that's basically what it is.
And speaking of the practice of yoga, I've been thinking about getting back to my practice of yoga, and I have been thinking about it for 3 years. So what's the policy? How do classes work?
For the lead classes, like mm-hmm. the one you came to on Sunday, and the beginner's lead class on Wednesday, people can just drop in for that.
Okay.
But for the morning practice, then people need to be coming on a regular basis because that's more of a practice time. Not so much of a class time, mm-hmm. but a time for people to work on their personal practice. So for that, they need to be here regularly so I can continually be aware of where they are in their practice, what they need to work on, when they can move on to something new, and how things need to be adjusted over time.
And that's how Ashtanga practice generally works.
Well, we have to look at the idea of practice and the idea of class. Most of the ways that yoga schools operate now are classes. You come and take class whenever you want. Oh, I'll go to your class. Oh, I'd like to go to his class. With this particular method of yoga, we're concerned with practice, which means what's a practice? It's something you do every day. If you have a meditation practice, you do it every day. If you're learning how to play guitar, you want to practice every day. So what does that mean? It means you practice your scales and you play the songs that you're learning how to do. And, and you look for mastery. You look for mastery in that thing that you are practicing. And what does mastery mean? Mastery means that the thing you practice becomes a part of you, that you can do it no matter what, under any circumstance because you have become the thing that you are practicing. You can sit in front of a piano and play whatever you need to because you and that piano are one. You can pick up your guitar and play any song at any time because you and your guitar have become one. You can get out of bed in the morning and bend over and touch your toes because you and your body have become one. And that's what mastery is. It doesn't mean that you're really great at something. It means that that thing, you have embodied it. It becomes normal for you. Like any time I ask you what your name is, you're going to say Marnie.
Right.
Under any circumstance, you and your name have become one. Whether or not they really are one, you know, whether it's just a designation of a name, doesn't matter. But anytime I ask you, what's your name? Even I wake you up. Even if you were asleep and I yelled out, Marnie, you'd lift your head up and go, what? So you have mastered your name. You know that it's you. And so for a practice, that's not a perfect analogy, but for a practice, you mastery means you have become that thing. You can do it at any time. It is normal for you. It is who you are. It's a part of you now. And that only comes from practice. It doesn't come from going to a class.
Right.
Okay, so what we do is we are concerned with helping people develop a practice so they can gain their own levels of mastery for the things that they're learning. And that only comes when you try on your own. The idea is that we teach you how to do something so that you can practice it wherever you are.
So that's what I think that's what I really love about this practice is that it's a routine and there is a series of asanas that you do one after the other. And it's always the same, sort of like the alphabet. So it doesn't, you know, there's always work to be done. But,
you know, if I want to learn how to speak French, which I want to learn how to do because my wife is French and so is my daughter, I'm going to go take classes at the, you know, wherever, somewhere around here. Yeah, exactly. And or I saw a place in Cobble Hill that I'm thinking of going to also. But then I'm going to say, okay, I want to go to France for 3 months so I can practice my French. I don't say I want to go to France so I can take, you know, classes every day in the street. I want to go there to practice my French. So we have to think about yoga and meditation in the same way. We have to stop thinking about these things as going to take a class.
Right.
That is not what yoga is for.
Right. But in today's modern society and culture, I think,
look, I'm going to say something which is not a popular view, but it's an honest one, which is in today's culture, we have realities like paying rent and paying teachers and making a living. And in order to do that, teaching something in a class structure is the best way to make an income like that. A lot of people don't have time or the inclination or the interest in turning something into a practice. They'd rather just go take a class and be free whenever they want. That's fine. That's their level of commitment. So I don't want to knock that necessarily.
Right.
It's a much better business model. And it's also a better model for people who, you know, they know their level of commitment is, I want to just do this when, you know, I feel that I need it. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever, but it isn't essentially what all of these traditions were meant for.
Right. As a practice, like a lifelong practice that you're constantly growing and evolving and doing.
Yeah. Something which is constantly referring you back to yourself. And, you know, when you repeat something like a meditation, like a mantra, like a series of poses, the sequence of the mantra might not change, but you change every day. You're different. So you get to measure yourself by this baseline. And then the baseline changes too. It gets steadier.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's interesting. I mean, I've always thought that was interesting about practicing here and Ashtanga.
But just we like let people, constant, you know, nowadays, I'm, you know, for the past dozen years or so, I've started letting people come like 3 times a week instead of insisting they come every day.
Yeah.
And most of this was after I had a child.
Right.
And I realized, okay, now I have some understanding about why it's difficult for people to get here every day.
Right.
When, you know, and so then I started being less strict about those types of things because it wasn't possible for people to come every day and they had good reason. And I didn't understand what those good reasons were. So as I, you know, became
a
father, then I thought, okay, I need to make it easier for people just to get here when they can. But we still have to have that thread of why we do this. You know, I'm not going to abandon that.
I think it's great how the studio has shifted with the times. When I first started practicing at Broome Street Temple, I was coming 3 or 4 times a week to practice Ashtanga, mostly Mysore. Now, I can barely make it to a drop-in leg class, but I'm coming back in 2018. I diverge. I would love to hear about your new app, the breathing app. That's so cool.
I'd be happy to tell you about the new app. It's called The Breathing App.
Uh-huh.
It's based on something called resonant or coherence breathing, mm-hmm. which is a particular breathing cycle where you breathe between 5 and 7 breaths per minute. Normally, we breathe about 15 to 18 breaths per minute, and we have basically two branches of our autonomic nervous system where all the automatic functions are happening, like our heart rate and respiration and blood pressure and body temperature and sleep and sexual reproduction. There's a sympathetic branch and a parasympathetic branch. These are complementary. They work with each other. Sympathetic moves us towards activity, like if I want to get up and walk across the room to get a glass of water. And the parasympathetic moves us towards anything restful. When I blink my eyes, when I exhale, when I'm ready to go to sleep, when I'm digesting food. All these things are operating all through the day. In our society, we tend a little bit more towards sympathetic because we have a lot more input of activity coming our way. 24-hour news cycle, smartphones, computers, electric lights, living in cities.
Right.
A lot of demands placed on us. And so the demands of the world, which are sometimes called environmental load, when they come at us consistently throughout the day and they start early and they end late, our sympathetic branch of our nervous system, that switch becomes flicked on and it stays on. And it leads to the body releasing things like adrenaline and cortisol and low levels to keep us sort of turned on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And adrenaline and cortisol have their places within our nervous system and within the, you know, hormonal system, but only at certain times. And when they're going all the time, then the body doesn't know what to do with them. And they start to create low levels of inflammation. So there's a lot of written
right.
about this these
yeah.
days.
Yeah.
And these low levels of inflammation can lead to a variety of diseases that are completely preventable. As you know, these are cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, the sympathetic drivers of certain cancers, anxiety, depression, inability to sleep, digestive problems. A whole host of things happen or go out of balance because of these, because of sympathetic activity and sympathetic drivers. So what this breathing rhythm does is it begins to, okay, so let me just go back again to sympathetic, like the switch is turned on. It's also been likened to an accelerator. And parasympathetic is like the braking mechanism. In particular, the vagus nerve, there's something called the vagal brake, which is the thing which is slowing down our heart rate. So the vagus nerve comes out from the brainstem and it travels down through the throat, through the trachea, the larynx, into the heart, the lungs, the diaphragm, and a lot of the internal organs like the stomach, the liver, the spleen, the pancreas, into the intestines. The vagus nerve has a far-reaching activity through the body. But the vagal brake in particular is the pacemaker of the heart. So it helps to slow the heart rate down. If it wasn't for this vagal brake, our heart rate would be driven by the sympathetic nervous system and it would be going about 100 beats per minute. And it's because of the vagal brake that our heart rate slows down to 65 to 72 beats per minute. So whenever we inhale, the brake is released a little and the heart rate speeds up slightly. Whenever we exhale, the brake is activated and the heart rate slows down a little. And this is called heart rate variability. This is a good thing. We want our heart rate to have a little bit of change in it depending on our activity level. And the way that we first see that is from the inhale and the exhale. So if our heart rate speeds up a little when we inhale, slows down a little when we exhale, we know that we have a nice little snapshot of our autonomic nervous system. And these two branches, sympathetic and parasympathetic, are doing what they need to. But for some people, with these low levels of stress and inflammation, this isn't really happening, or it's not happening in the right times or in the right way. If you have anxiety, if you have too much input, which we call stress, stress is actually a neutral force. Negative stress or too much stress is called distress, and the stress that helps us grow is called eustress. Like if you're training, You want a certain amount of stress so you can get better at that thing you're doing. Right. So stress is neutral. It all depends on how well we adapt to it. When we don't adapt well, it's called distress, and it's going to throw off the function of sympathetic and parasympathetic, and then it's going to show up in our heart rate variability. Heart rate variability, not changing too much. It'll be like low heart rate variability. High heart rate variability is desirable. So for athletes, they know a lot about heart rate variability, and they watch it and they measure it, and they know that they can have peak performance when their heart rate variability is at a certain zone. So what the app does is it brings you into this frequency where the sympathetic and parasympathetic branches become in an equilibrium. And it resets the vagal brake by toning the vagus nerve and helps to recalibrate the braking mechanism of the parasympathetic nervous system. And over a period of time, like, you know, say about 5 weeks of doing it every day for about 15 to 20 minutes, even 10 minutes is enough, you begin to reset your baseline resiliency of your ability to deal with stress. And this is shown from better heart rate variability, a calmer mind, less anxiety, better sleep. All these things automatically begin to happen as your nervous system starts to reset itself.
And can you, and then you obviously also learn how to breathe without the app, so you can use this anytime, even if you don't have your phone.
The idea behind it is that we want to not become dependent upon technology to know how we feel. We want to become not dependent on technology to know how we're performing also. So we made this app specifically to train people to see what it feels like to be in this particular coherent zone so they can do it whenever they need to without having to use the app. So after about 5 weeks or so of regular use, you don't really need to use it anymore, and you can just use it when you want to.
I think it's great. And so how long have you been working on it?
About 2 years.
And it's you and who else you have other partners in the app, right?
Yeah, Deepak Chopra helped with the science behind it. And my friend Sergey Verichev is the coder. He's from Belarus, but he lives in Amsterdam. And Moby, the musician and artist, did the tones that we use coherence.
So I think it's amazing that you have an app that helps you breathe. It's like,
and
almost,
it's free also.
Yes.
It's free on the iTunes store.
So what's your business model?
My business model is...
Because your class is free this weekend too.
Yeah, it is. My business model is terrible. My business model is that breathing is free, so the app should be free too.
I love it.
You know, why should we charge for something which is just going to help make you do what you already do freely, but do it better?
So I feel like that the big lesson here with this app and generally with yoga is breathing, and with everything is breathing. And so it's really important to breathe.
It is. We're breathing beings. So what are some things which are interrupting our breathing? Anxiety, anger, frustration, too much stress, too much environmental load and the inability to deal with it, depression, low levels of sadness, not feeling what your purpose is in your life, feeling that you're separate from everything. All of these things, they actually interrupt the flow of our breath. And by simply getting in touch with our breathing and establishing that harmonious flow of the breath again, some of these things can be released a little bit. Even anger can be released a little. Anxiety can be released a little bit. A feeling of, you know, being separate can be released a little bit. And even when just a little bit of room is created, it can lead to so many good changes. Okay, so we were talking about elephants and Ganesh earlier. So every year, you know, what I do is I make a list of the things in my life which I think I value and that are important to me. Then I look at that list and I check and I see, am I really adhering to the things that I say I value? Sometimes we say we value something, but we don't really pay much attention to it. And so making a list is a good way of seeing, am I really living up to my values? So this year, I've made my list already. And one of the things I decided was that I have not been doing enough to live up to the value that I place on the planet that we live on. I mean, I take a lot of planes and I use a cell phone and I have a computer and I drive a Vespa and I live in a city and I contribute to a lot of pollution. And I decided, okay, this year I want to go back to reaffirming and acknowledging like my life on this planet. So what I'm doing, and especially also because we have a Ganesh temple, is that I've decided to put a lot of support towards saving the elephants this year. And I have a friend, David Bonouvrier, and his wife, Trish Goff, and David owns a modeling agency called DNA. And he and Trish started something called Not On My Planet, K-N-O-T, On My Planet. And they work with the Elephant Crisis Fund in Africa, basically, to save elephants, to protect elephants, and to stop the poaching, which is leading to the wholesale destruction of elephants for their ivory tusks. There's an elephant killed every 15 minutes for their tusks. And these are majestic, beautiful animals.
Still in this day and age.
Still in this day and age. It's crazy, and it's... And elephants are called, they're a keystone species, which means that they keep alive particular ecosystems just because they exist. And when the elephant's gone, then a whole ecosystem will disappear, many other species along with them. So they're like sort of a crucial species. There are other keystone species as well. But because, you know, I kind of worship an elephant-headed deva, it seems ridiculous for me to worship something which is modeled on a real living being, and then not do something to protect and worship that being too. So I would like to ask all of your listeners, if you feel so inclined, if you go to the Elephant Crisis Fund or to Not On My Planet and give a little donation to help save the elephants. So that's coming up now, you know, whenever you hear this. What else? I have three different video series out now. One of them is on Om Stars, which is a like sort of a yoga teacher website. And I have a video course on the nervous system and on some yoga philosophy, some of the things we just spoke about. And then on something called One World Yogis. Actually, you can look at healthwire.fm. I have a series of 10 videos for stress reduction and resiliency. For people who go onto that website, you can get a subscription and see a ton of content for like $4.99 a month. But that series, that video series, is being released on January 1st to the entire U.S. military for free, and it will be given to all service people in this country and in others to begin developing a stress reduction and resiliency practices for the military before either they go into active duty, before they go into conflict zones, to see if it has any effect on dealing with PTSD and with all the stress of you know, trying to protect the things that they protect, like our country and other people in other countries as well. So, and then I'll be going to different military bases next year and doing trainings with the military in different areas, at different army bases in this country and in others as well. And that's all being given free to the military. I mean, they'll pay for my travel, but I'm not charging for that. To teach them. So that's on healthwire.fm. And then the last video series is on jio.com, J-I-Y-O.com. And that's Deepak Chopra and Poonacha Machaya's wellness platform. And there's like a beginner yoga series and yoga for athletes on that particular thing. I have a book coming out with FSG, Ferris Strauss and Giroux. That'll be coming out next year, towards the end of the year. And then I have another book coming out in January, which is, and that book is more yoga philosophy for beginners. It's called The Little Beginner's Book of Yoga. And then I have another one coming out in January called The Mysore Diaries, which are my journals from Mysore from 1999.
That's so awesome. I'm so excited.
So yeah, those are some of the things going on.
That's so exciting. And your website and your handles on social media. Do you want to?
Okay. Yeah. That? On Instagram, I'm at Eddie Stern. And I don't use Facebook, and I have a Twitter handle also at Eddie Stern, but I never post anything on it. Instagram is really the only thing I like. My website is ayny.org, and then you can see, you know, I travel about 8 times a year to different places in Europe and other countries to teach workshops, so, you know, I get around a little bit.
So people can look on your website to find out where you're going to be. And this is also a B&B. So if people are listening from anywhere in the U.S. or around the world, they can, you know, come for a week and
yep,
stay
totally
here and
absolutely
practice yoga.
100%.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Eddie.
Thank you, Marnie.
I'm so excited.
I'm looking forward to seeing you back in class every week now.
Yes, I'm going to be here every week. That is awesome. My intention.
Sunday is great. Once a week.
Sunday.
Yeah, that's do it once a week.
I can do that. Totally. Yeah.
You know, I think that when it comes to picking, when you decide to commit to something, choose your level of commitment.
Right, like with the reality of what you can really do.
Exactly. And then when you live up to that commitment, you feel good.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I can't do headstand.
That's okay.
It'll happen. One day, I'll be 90.
Happy New Year to all your listeners and to you as well.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. That was Eddie Stern. This is Marnie Salop. Okay, it's a wrap. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And please don't forget to check out the show notes for anything that we mentioned in the episode. Also, please subscribe to the podcast and follow us on social media. Instagram @MarnieSalop, Facebook, Marnie on the Move.